We're going to get started here.
Burning daylight.
Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education Innovation and Workforce Development, Friday, March 13th. We have a busy agenda with a number of bills. First thing is to announce that, unfortunately, Representative Buckley is not yet back with us, so we're going to carry over his bill, House Bill 2670, once again, and hope that he is feeling healthy and with us on Monday. With that, we're going to open concurrent public hearings on House Bill 2254, 2832, and House Bill 3184. Representative Holby, Representative Nathanson, if you could join us. I understand Ms. Heemstra from the DOJ is going to come up with you, and while you get settled, we'd love to hear a summary from you. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2254 prohibits public or private post-secondary educational institution from entering into contract with student financial aid management firm unless contract meets specified requirements, requires approval by the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for public or private post-secondary educational institution to contract with third-party financial firm for management of student financial accounts, declares an emergency, is effective on passage. We have dash two amendments which replace the heck with the AG and allow DOJ costs to be passed along to third-party financial service providers, and dash three amendments which remove the third-party review of contracts. House Bill 3184 directs the State Treasurer, in consultation with Higher Education Coordinating Commission, to negotiate contracts to permit financial institution to provide student financial aid services to students enrolled at public universities or community colleges, declares emergency, is effective on passage. Dash one, State Treasurer to convene meeting of financial aid services to discuss issues related to financial aid service contracts. The dash two amendments require the AG approval and renegotiation, if necessary, of contracts. The dash three amendments require the State Treasurer to assist in procurement of third-party financial aid disbursement and management services. House Bill, what am I doing here? 3832 requires public university or community college that contracts with financial institution, organization, or other institution for financial aid services to make contract publicly available.
Thank you very much. Representative Nathanson, are you starting us, or Representative Holby, or Ms. Heemstra? Who's first?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go ahead and go first in front of the ladies. I'm speaking to House Bill 2254, and for the record, my name is Paul Holby, State Representative District 8. This bill was brought forward, pre-session filed, if I recall, when I was chairing the Consumer Protection Committee. A little background or history, this bill has passed passed the House before, but has not made it through the whole process. We've been following this issue since 2012, actually before that, with great concerns about the practices that are involved in the lending practices that are involved in third-party financial firms operating and facilitating the financial aid accounts for students. And specifically, their terms debit card and the charges and some of the practices involved in the contracts that are involved with the schools with these third-party financial firms. We wanted to just point out that one of the reasons the bill, I suppose, has struggled along the way is because the argument was the Department of Education is taking care of this. And after several settlements at the national level, which I think the Attorney General's office may speak to a little bit later, with some of the institutions that are in this industry and those sorts of settlements, we still are waiting for the Department of Education, though they keep making recommendations. It's been 5 or 6 years while they've been considering this, and there's nothing that precludes the state of Oregon from going ahead and making some requirements of the contracts that our schools in the state of Oregon enter into with these firms. And we became concerned about this when we, the Oregon Student Association, brought this to the attention of consumer protection because of the practices and terms of the credit cards and the contracts that allowed revenue sharing with the schools and involved pretty steep fees for swipe, what we call swipe fees. Every time they swipe a card, they get another charge. They non-sufficient fund fees that were very high compared to the rest of the lending market, what regular consumers are looking at. And so this became a consumer issue for our committee, and it's since that time has now been moved over to the education venue, which is perfectly fine. There's a lot of concerns about how these fees are not really consistent with the federal rules on financial aid. And that's one of the things I think the Department of Education is looking at. And they've done a study of some schools around the country, of which Portland State University was one, where they reviewed some of the conditions and practices on this issue, and have made a report that I may or may not be on OLIS, but it will be shortly. Oh, it is. And so I think that's worth looking at, to look at some of what we're trying to get to. Sometimes the federal government moves extremely slow. We can wait years, if not decades, for some sort of action. And so I bring this bill forward to address some of those fees and some of the practices that are involved in these contracts. Became also concerned that one company would have different contracts with different schools, and they all had different terms and different sorts of practices involved. And we sort of became alarmed that, you know, wondering why we weren't getting, you know, a good contract that covers all our schools. So it's a little more difficult now that we've made a lot of our schools independent to do that. But I still remain concerned, and I think many others still remain concerned, about the expertise of schools to enter into these contracts. Certainly they have attorneys, but the fact that they were doing revenue sharing, which means they were essentially getting money back from these financial third-party institutions, getting money back from what those institutions were actually charging the students. And so it seemed like a backdoor shift of costs to students, and raising their costs at the same time we're having trouble with default rates of students on their loans. So we're, you know, putting them at risk to some degree in financial arrangements where the terms and practices are questionable, if not unethical. And so, you know, I'm not sure our schools have the expertise to look at these contracts and to recognize these sorts of predatory setups. So that was one of the reasons we wanted the HEC to review those, and we've now come to agreement that the HEC really doesn't want to do that, and they probably don't have the expertise to do that either. So you do have an amendment in front of you which allows the DOJ to review these contracts if we give them the authority to do so, and to recover their costs for doing that. And if the committee feels that that's not appropriate, we do have an amendment that takes out the review, and we'll just hope that the schools do a better job of looking at contracts and looking for predatory practices and ethical concerns, and really making sure that those things are addressed in their contracts going forward. I hope that is something that we do look at. I mean, there's a lot of information in this. I do hope you do take a look at this. It is alarming when you see the millions and millions of dollars that are basically coming out of financial aid accounts and student accounts that are going to these third-party financial institutions, when those monies really are, you know, earmarked for helping students get an education and afford an education. And so that simple issue seems to be in conflict, and I think the Department of Education calls that out, with the federal laws around the use of Title IV funds, for sure. So we just bring this forward to, and I know Representative Nathanson has been working on this, and we've talked a lot about this as well, and has a couple other bills. I can't speak specifically to her bills, but certainly I think she can do a good job of that. And so I'm supportive of her positions and where she's trying to go too. I think it really is something that the state of Oregon should do. It's been highlighted across the country that Oregon's had a problem with this. And, you know, we've been noticing this for a long time. And I'm frustrated that we don't take action because we have such faith in our federal government that they will take action and address this. And we do have purview over these schools that are registered and licensed in the state of Oregon. And we can dictate what kind of contracts they enter into and what kind of things should be in those contracts. And I really hope that I think the schools have recognized some of this and are trying to change some of these practices right now. But, you know, I think we need to make a statement here and ensure that this happens with all our schools. So thank you very much for allowing me to testify this morning, and I look forward to your looking at these bills and trying to figure out what to do with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hall. I know you have other obligations. If you can stick around a little bit until we hear from the rest of the panel, I expect we may have some questions for you. Thank you. Who's next?
I'll go next.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. Over the past decade, Oregon students have borrowed more than $12.2 billion to finance their education. The financial burden, as you know, is tremendous. I want to thank Representative Holvey for the conversations we've been having over the past year or more about how to address this, the student debt, but also the use of the debit cards and how the financial services industry is playing a role in students being able to use their financial aid. Several times over the past year, my staff and I have had conversations with the National Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB. They have been helping us to understand the issues surrounding student debit cards. It's not just Oregon, it's nationwide. The market blossomed after Congress passed the CARD Act in 2009. The financial aid disbursement market is generally made up of Pell Grant recipients who are already borrowing heavily to go to college. The student debit cards, as Representative Holden mentioned, the student debit cards generate revenue for the financial institutions and also for the colleges, but the revenue is actually coming out of the pockets of the impoverished students. At many colleges across Oregon, students, to access their financial aid, are stuck using the debit cards that are the product of contracts with sometimes unfavorable terms and aggressive marketing. At that same time, the students are given little or no information about the terms of those cards before they start using them. Then they start using the card, and they start incurring fees. But wait, if they don't use the card, in some cases, they pay a fee of $19 for not using the card. It's called an inactivity fee. So if you think you don't want to pay the fees, you just don't use the card, but then you pay another fee. The result is an added financial burden to Oregon students who are already reeling from debt. I have two bills that I'm presenting to you. I'm going to speak about both of them instead of two separate approaches. One of the bills, House Bill 2832, is simply about transparency. It's to pierce through the secrecy around the contracts between the colleges and the financial institutions that issue those debit cards to students. At a minimum, the bill requires the publication of the contracts on the websites of the public universities and community colleges that are using the debit cards to distribute financial aid. Making the information available will level the playing field for Oregon students. The current playing field is far from level. When it comes to negotiating the terms of the contracts, colleges are not necessarily well positioned to represent the interests of the students. It's understandable the colleges are representing the interests of the colleges, and they need to ensure the best deal for the college for their financial and business purposes. The deals often include incentives for schools to aggressively market those debit cards to the students. The Federal Government Accountability Office, or GAO, released a report noting that those contracts often include direct payments to schools from card providers based on the number of accounts or the number of transactions. As a result, the schools, rather than presenting neutral information on all the options the students have, will use aggressive marketing tactics to get students to use those cards. By accepting the student debit cards, students expose themselves to fees that can be both steep and frequent. Common fees charged to students include a variety of per-swipe fees, like 50 cents each time. Some providers charge a fee for card purchases using a personal identification number, or PIN, instead of a signature. To use your PIN, you pay a fee. A fee to load or reload a prepaid card, $25 to transfer the money to another account. Let's say you want to use a bank or credit union account that you have. So there's $25 to transfer your money to something that may cost you less to use. $4.50 to use another system's ATM when you're off campus or back at home. And then there was that $19 fee if you decided not to use your card. The total amount of fees is not known because some providers have declined to give information on what they're collecting in fees. The contracts are often secret, and the general public, much less students, can't get the information about the contract. So one of those bills is simply transparency. Publish the contract. Let us start seeing what you've signed. You have a variety of bills and amendments to consider. 2832 was just about transparency, but how about if we get better contracts and better deals? Representative Holvey has represented to you a bill that would do that. I have a bill also, House Bill 3184, which takes a different approach. You will see in front of you several amendments. Some of the amendments that we have had prepared are necessary. You might call them housekeeping. It's to clarify language and take care of issues that were presented to us by either the financial community or a university or someone who explained you need to clarify the language that we are included or we're not included. However, there is a new amendment that you don't have in front of you yet. It has not been prepared, which I think has a promising approach, and I want to let you know about it today. There will be another amendment that suggests that the task be assigned to the Shared Services Enterprise that was set up for the Oregon universities. You may recall, as OUS was dismantled and the smaller institutions in particular might need help with some things that the larger institutions were more positioned to take care of. The amendment will task this shared services enterprise to add to their list of shared services that they can negotiate. We'll ask them to convene, be the venue for this collaboration so that universities and community colleges would join together collaboratively, and that would be the venue for negotiating a better contract that they could use. These bills will help Oregon's students be heard. They will result in better deals for the students' pocketbook, and they will bring the contracts to light. I hope that you will consider raising the bar on behalf of Oregon students. Make these contracts public and find a way to get a better deal. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Ms. Heemstra.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm sort of pinch hitting today for Legislative Director Aaron Knott. Just a few quick points. As you may know, the Attorney General is the main enforcer of our main consumer protection law, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. As such, we track national scale consumer protection issues, and the use of intermediaries to disperse financial aid awards has been on our radar. We testified last year, I believe. First of all, I want to say that valuable financial intermediaries they provide a good service. The financial aid offices are basically seasonal. They have a lot of work to do in a short amount of time, and outsourcing that work sometimes makes a lot of sense. These intermediaries do provide real savings opportunities for students and for colleges. They do sometimes offer trainings and help students become more financially responsible. However, the basic problem here is that students don't really have freedom to make free market-driven decision between providers. The cards here are often provided in forms that suggest they are official or required as part of registration. In some states, the disbursements are both awarded as distributed and have the student IDs double as the debit cards. Students may find opt-outs, but they are often buried through relatively small text at registration, and the acceptance of the conditions imposed by the intermediaries are often default conditions. So most students probably wouldn't catch all the conditions buried in these contracts. Also, the contracts vary quite a bit from state to state and from college to college, and this sort of creates a whack-a-mole environment. Representative Holvey mentioned two enforcement actions that have taken place, and I would like to highlight those. First of all, in 2012, the FDIC announced a settlement with Higher One and Bancorp Bank for approximately $11 million. That was restitution for about 60,000 students. The FDIC determined that institutions were charging student account holders multiple non-sufficient fund fees from a single transaction, allowing accounts to be repeatedly accrued these non-sufficient fund fees when an account fell below a given balance. These were nicknamed zombie fees. And collecting these fees from other linked student accounts without permission. Often these accounts were the ones dedicated to just paying tuition, but they were pulling fees from the tuition-based accounts. The second action, this was 2013, this was a class action against Higher One that was for $15 million. The core allegations there were basically automatic account creation for students, depositing students' financial aid funds into Higher One accounts without students' permission, discouraging students from opting out, and imposing unusual fee structures, as Representative Nathanson mentioned. So as you can see, as I mentioned, there's sort of a whack-a-mole environment here. There's no good way to chase down individually each and every contract because they change too quickly. The only effective method of regulating is to, first of all, make these contracts public, get some transparency, and second of all, make sure somebody is watching these contracts. Representative Holvey mentioned, and Representative Nathanson mentioned, there have been some talks at the federal level. The CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and Department of Education have both made allusions to possible issuance of rules. At this time, there has been no meaningful involvement. I believe about a year ago, we had a hearing on this, and some of the proponents, stakeholders mentioned that there was optimism for federal action. We do not see that happening at this time. Nothing is immediately pending. Last and final point, as you've heard, some of the amendments were the Department of Justice as the sort of watchdog over these contracts. Of course, DOJ is willing to perform contractual review, and we definitely have the technical capacity. We just don't know if it makes the most fiscal sense at this point. Also, we have, as you know, we've decoupled from the system, the OUS system, and we have no pre-existing billing mechanism or an attorney-client relationship at this point. We are certainly happy. I think there's going to be more talks going on, and we're happy to be there at the table and happy to be part of any work group to decide and help decide where this goes. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Questions? Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Chair Reed. So I have an additional question probably for maybe all of you. I like the concept that we're developing here. I think these fees are something that is overburdensome. But there is also entities out there that are feeder entities to the entities that you're talking about, such as aggregate companies that aggregate on the web that say, put your name in here, put your identification in here, and we will give you a list of from 3 million different financial aid packages available to you, and you pay a fee for that. And I think that there is some appropriateness to that, to let students just start the search of, you know, what financial aid is out there. Then they go to the entities that you might be talking about that are contracted with the schools to help them. But that initial step, is that being looked at, or would there be an ability to look at these aggregate companies that put them all together, that somebody might just go on and do a Google search in the state of Oregon and look at those fees to see what they look like? Or is that too expansive here?
It may be too expansive. I think maybe it could be considered in some of these bills, as it pertains to the financial, you know, the regulation of the student financial accounts. I don't know that I can really speak to that very well. You know, the just offering the information is really not what I think this particular bill was about.
Agreed.
This bill was more about, you know, these what I would consider unethical and predatory practices that are inside of these contracts. That was really the focus. And, you know, these bills haven't addressed all of the issues that maybe should be in them. You know, there was a lot of talk about, you know, whether or not a school should, in a financial institution, should have a card with the school's name on top of it, you know, kind of giving the illusion that these are approved, you know, and got a seal of approval from an Oregon school. So, I mean, there's a lot of different pieces to this. I don't know that we'll address that.
Representative Holman, it seems to me, and Representative Hayden, that there may be two things going on here, that the bills here are a relatively narrow slice of the whole financial aid picture. Your question, it strikes me, is a good one, but perhaps a little bit broader.
Right.
Representative McEwen's got a lot of experience with OSAC and other things, so I think you may have a perspective on this, too.
It might be helpful, and again, your point's very well taken, and I think I know where you're coming from. I think we're talking about apples and oranges here. When a student is interested in investigating what financial aid opportunities they might have, they can go on the web, and there are a plethora of websites that give a lot of information. Pell Grant and Oregon Opportunity are very specific. If they want to go out and look at lending opportunities, there's a broad range that they can look at. But I would just wanted to clarify what you are trying to talk about. Once the student is in the system and they are attending the university and they've been awarded a financial aid package, this is the contract that the school has with an institution that allows money to be transferred into a student account that they can access with a debit card, which is after the process you're talking
right,
about
right,
has already occurred.
Right.
I'm just
That's correct.
Just trying to kind of clarify this. I would love to talk to you about your question. We can have a sidebar.
Okay.
I would enjoy that very much if it would be helpful.
And to further clarify, Chair Representative McEwen, you know, inside of 2254 at least, we also wanted to make sure the students have a right to receive a paper check of the financial aid and enter, you know, establish their own account and not be, you know, so they have a choice.
Right.
Many of the way these things are set up, they have very little choice. They have to figure out how to opt out of it, and it's not very clear on their websites on how you can accomplish this. And I think the report I referred to the Department of Education will mention that as well.
And Representative Holvey, I absolutely agree that we have our students in a very untenable situation, and I'm really delighted that all of you are bringing this to us. This is a complicated issue. You can see from the number of bills that have come before us right now, but this is something we've got to deal with. We've put our students at a tremendous disadvantage, and these are things that I think as a state we have a responsibility to deal with, so I couldn't be more delighted that you're here before us today.
Thanks. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did, as I recall, hear this bill 2 years ago in consumer protection, and I think it's important. important, and I hope we'll hear from some of the institutional people here, too, to provide context. But, you know, the institutions, I think, at one point in time were in the business of making those disbursements to students of the financial aid package, and they chose to offload that or sub it out to third-party entities because it saves money. The institution doesn't have the bandwidth necessarily to be able to manage all of these accounts, or they could do that, but it means that they would have to not do something else or add on FTE, which would raise their costs, which would in turn raise the price of education for kids. So that's the rationale why third-party entities are used. But we also heard, too, and I hope, you know, obviously we'll get more testimony, but, you know, at the point in time of signing up for the loan disbursement and so forth, that there is, you know, information available at that time if the students are paying attention or if they are focusing on what the fine print really says, you know, and so forth. But regarding fees and so forth, you know, I mean, every time, you know, some transactions I make, if I grab, you know, use a cash machine or whatever, I'm charged a fee at that point in time, too. So these fees, you know, are what we live with. And I'm not saying that all these fees are necessarily justified, but somebody has to get paid for these transactions and stuff at some point in time just to manage the, you know, manage the books. Everybody's in the business to keep the doors open and so forth. But I guess I would be a little bit concerned about employing DOJ. I do think there would be a fiscal impact there. I can see some advantages of being transparent and as publicly open as possible. I don't think that should be too burdensome. But anyway, I look forward to hearing the whole perspective here from both students and I think the institutions themselves.
Mr. Chair, comment,
please,
about that. I appreciate Representative Johnson's statement, and I do realize that this is a cost savings to the schools. And but the reality is the cost savings is really just a cost shift to the students. And in that cost shift, in that management of the financial aid accounts, you'll also maybe hear from the students about, you know, the counseling about, well, does it make sense to go into the financial debt to in this field of fly fishing or basket weaving where you don't have a good prospect for repaying those loans if you don't, you know, you don't have the wealth to do that. And so I lament that our system doesn't have, and I know our schools are really strapped because of the lack of revenue, but I lament the fact that they don't really get good counseling oftentimes, especially when going into debt. And I mean, that's something that, you know, I think is a different committee's purview than consumer protection, certainly, and a slightly different purview than this committee even. So I just wanted to comment on that, and, you know, I just hope you look at this in a broad sense.
Thanks. Representative McCune.
Thank you, Chair Reed. And Representative Holvey, I just think you've touched on something that's really important, and I think it's the purview of maybe a number of committees that operate in this building. But what responsibility do we have as a state in educating our students on how to be good consumers? And, you know, there's effort that goes into that on some fronts, but maybe on not enough fronts. I'm not sure how we get at that. We don't require coursework, I don't think, across the state anymore on personal finance and training students on how to look at a contract or even know that they should be asking those questions. A lot of students come out of high school going off to college with no training at all as to how that they begin to investigate what's in their best interest of choice. And how much debt to go into and how to try and understand a banking institution's kind of a fundamental basis on how they are a financially viable business, but also protect our students from predatory practices that, again, put them at a tremendous disadvantage. So I think all the right questions are being asked here, and these are all things that we need to wrestle with.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I wanted to respond briefly to a few points that have been made. Mr. Chair, and also Representative Johnson, absolutely on the issue of fees, and we have to pay for the service that is being delivered. I certainly agree. I think there are two points that we can help with. One is Generally, when you're making your banking choices, you consider options. Am I going to go to this bank or this bank or this bank or this credit union? You look at the various options you have and the costs based on your own financial circumstances. And you pick the thing that fits your financial or lifestyle needs and you know, or where the ATMs are located or any number of things that go into your decision. This is probably something that students had no idea of when they selected what kind of financial aid they were going to apply for, what they were going to receive, and then would have no idea what it was going to cost them to use a card just to be able to access their financial aid. So part of it is when you have a student who's in the disadvantaged position of not having had the options about that particular aspect of their business relationship with the college. The second...
Representative Nathanson, I'm going to interrupt for just a moment to explain that I have to go testify next door, so
okay.
I'm passing the gavel to Representative Gallegos. I'll be back
Thank
in
you.
A few minutes.
The second thing I wanted to bring up is in two of the bills, not the transparency bill, but the two bills that you have that deal with contracting, I think there is some hope that by setting up a way of implementing or encouraging, incentivizing negotiation of either larger contracts, collaborative contracts among several institutions, or even a statewide contract, that through volume, the potential for volume, you may have the result of increased competition in Oregon. You may have other institutions who decide they want to enter the arena and start responding to requests for proposal or requests for information, for example. So you may be able to actually increase competition, bring down some of those rates, make better deals, and end up with a better situation for students, but also perhaps a bit more competitive marketplace in the private sector. So I'm hoping that with the option of advising, instructing, however, whichever options you decide you may want to pursue from the bills that are available, by asking someone to initiate statewide or a collaboration among two or three or a half a dozen schools, you may be able to help improve the marketplace in a positive way.
If there's no other questions, well, thank you, Representative Nathanson and Ms. Hilstra. I think that from my perspective, financial aid, the whole purpose of financial aid is to assist students and keep their stress at a minimum so that they can spend time studying. I mean, that's the whole purpose, as I understand it, as a professor. And I think the notion that you bring to us in terms of at least the transparency and really helping us to look at and make sure that students are protected and we're not shifting costs to students as we search so diligently here on this committee to really reduce the cost of students in higher education. So thank you for bringing this. I think there may be some other folks that want to come up.
Thanks for being here.
Eric Knoll and Mario Parker Milligan.
Thank you.
Good morning, Vice Chair Gallegos and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Knoll. I serve as the student body president at Portland State University, and you've seen me here in the building as an intern with Mario for the Oregon Student Association.
For the record, my name is Mario Parker Milligan. I'm the legislative director with the Oregon Student Association.
We wanted to come in this morning and provide a bit of background for this issue. Both of us had the opportunity to work on House Bill 4102 last session that discussed a lot of what Representative Holvey talked about earlier and a lot of the content we see in House Bill 2254. There you go. So we want to frame this issue a little bit for all of you. We're talking about students receiving their refund on their financial aid. So students receive financial aid, and whatever is left over after students pay for tuition and fees is sent back to them in the form of a refund. Some students or some institutions issue paper checks, some institutions direct deposit to the student's account, and some, as you've heard, contract with third-party financial aid disbursement firms. But The financial aid sources that students use to pay for this, as you know, are the Oregon Opportunity Grant, Pell Grants, student loans, and private scholarships and grants. So this is the type of money that we're looking at when we're talking about the funding that comes back to students. A quick overview. There are six institutions in Oregon contracted with Higher One. Higher One is a financial aid disbursement company that owns the majority of the market when it comes to student debit cards. This graphic was produced just prior to, I believe, Higher One acquiring Sallie Mae as well. So that purple slice in the pie now becomes part of the 56% blue slice of the pie. And we also note that other campuses use similar services to this in Oregon. But for the intents of our presentation, we want to focus on the six institutions that are contracted with Higher One and the services they offer. Representative Holvey Nathanson spoke earlier about some of the fees incurred to student accounts, and I won't go over those too much in depth, but two of the main fees that are focused on by students and that we'd like to focus on in this discussion are first the 50-cent debit transaction fee. Every time a student swipes their debit card that they receive as a debit card, they are charged 50 cents on a transaction. Students are also charged frequently for a $2.50 non-Higher One ATM fee. Higher One provides ATMs on account or on campuses they contract with. I believe there are 13 Higher One ATMs across the state of Oregon, four of which are at Portland State. All of these ATMs, though, are in buildings that lock at some point in the day and that are not accessible to students maybe over spring break or winter break. So a lot of times you have students who maybe live off campus or who can't get to campus before a building closes and have to use a non-Higher One ATM, at which point they are charged $2.50 by Higher One by their debit card company, as well as potentially if they were to use a Bank of America account or Bank of America ATM, they would be charged $3 on top of that. So a student may be charged $5.50 to withdraw $20. We also look at the revenue that Higher One brings in on an annual basis. This is nationwide. In 2013, they brought in a revenue of about $211 million. 64% of that was from fees assessed to student accounts. And that at the time was about $134 million. In 2012, 76% of 197 turned out to be about $150 million. So we're, to a degree, looking at student financial aid in Oregon, like the Oregon Opportunity Grant, being sent to Connecticut, where Higher One is headquartered. I also included two photos of the cards that students receive. As you see here with the Southern Oregon and PSU debit cards, it very much looks like something that the institution provides. You receive a card in the mail and sign up for an account. These cards may also duplicate as student IDs on some campuses, including Portland State. So the reason I talked about...
Vice Chair Gagas.
Sure.
So am I understanding you, would you mind going back? Am I understanding you to say that that card actually is a student ID? Mm-hmm.
So Chair Gallegos, Representative McEwen, yes, that's correct. In coming from Portland State, I received my Higher One card in the mail. And could use it as an ID, but a lot of buildings on campus, they now have electronic ID swipes on the sides, but this card does not work for those. So you would have to have to go and get an alternative ID. But this is an acceptable form of ID for student events, for the bookstore, and other activities on campus.
Okay, thank you.
So given the fee schedule, and we have sent in to have a copy of Higher One's fee schedule attached with the materials. Given this fee schedule, a lot of students, if they understand and want to opt out of using a debit card for their financial aid refund, can choose alternatives. They can choose to opt out when signing up for the Higher One account online to receive a paper check or an electronic funds transfer. So they would have to go in and create an account online. They would select an alternative. And then they would, if they chose to select an electronic funds transfer, they'd enter their bank account information. But after that, it would require the student to print off a form, sign the form, and then fax or mail that to a Higher One. And then it would take at least 1 to 2 weeks for that to be processed and set up. It's a one-time processing. But go ahead.
Oh, and Chair Kai, I'm sorry, I don't mean to keep stopping you, but this is intriguing to me. Mm-hmm. If you do opt out, is that an annual event? Is that as long as you have a Higher One account, do you have to do it every term? How often do you have to go through that opt-out process?
Vice Chair Gallegos, Representative McEwen, thanks for the question. A student only needs to opt out once. But as a lot of students have seen, it is a burdensome process and one that can be, to a degree, misdirecting. And I'll advance to the next two slides. During my process of opting out through the account setup, I did take a couple of screenshots of what was offered to me. So when I signed up when I received my card and chose to opt out, I went, set up my account with Higher One, and then was able to choose one of three options to opt out. So here I was given these three options: one, that I could receive my money the same day from Higher One. Or that I could deposit to another account, or that I could receive a paper check. But as you see, both of these columns have multiple extra steps associated with them, as well as colors that I would argue signify warning signs or a do not go. Additionally, at the bottom, you would have to select either the option of the green button to select the one account or the gray button to show options. And then when you clicked, or when I clicked show options, I was still given all three again and had to select from there. So when we talk about students having the ability to clearly accessibly opt out of a contract, the number one source of revenue for these card companies are fees associated with their account. It's not in the company's best interest to provide students alternative methods that don't have fees associated with them. Additionally, students would be charged to receive a paper check if they were to choose that method. So last year, I've served in student government at Portland State for 2 years, and last year I worked with our student government to conduct a survey of our student population. We collected about 860 student responses in response to the current renegotiations of our institution's Higher One contract, as well as students bringing it to us as a priority. We asked 10 questions in the survey related to ATMs, distribution, returned assessed fees, customer service, and demographic information. I won't cover all of that for you, but I will highlight a couple of key data points from our survey. The first is that when we looked at respondents' age, almost three-quarters of respondents were under the age of 29, but we still saw a significant population above the age of 30. We asked students up front, do you want an alternative for Higher One as your financial aid disbursement? And almost 70% of students said yes, they would prefer a different option than Higher One on campus. We asked students if they had used Higher One's customer service, if they had any questions or having difficulty. 30% of respondents to that question said yes. And of those 30%, I would highlight only 26% said their experience was either excellent or good. 29% said it was fair, and 45% said they had a poor or awful experience in working with Higher One's customer service. And then this was probably the most telling for us, in that we asked students, one, if they were confident that they knew of higher ones, or they know higher ones' fees, and that if their fees were acceptable to them. Only 22% of students said that they actually knew and understood what fees they are being charged. And then of the respondents, again, only 22% responded that their fees were acceptable and reasonable. We also have looked at two federal studies that were conducted early last year around student debit cards. And it was brought up earlier in Representative Nathanson's testimony about the Government Accountability's Office College Debit Cards Report. We also came across a U.S. Department of Education report from March of 2014. This report came out just after a session concluded last year. But this report studied four institutions, including Portland State, specifically in their compliance with Title IV of the Higher Education Act related to financial aid disbursement. So I won't go too in-depth to the GAO report. Both of these reports we've submitted as exhibits with our testimony as well. What I will highlight are three things. One is that the GAO suggested that these reports be made available for public review. The second is that additional clarity needs to be provided on what constitutes convenient access to ATMs. And then the third is that schools and debit cards should be required to provide at least neutral information to students about their options for receiving their refunds. The United States Department of Education report focused more on the institution's role in compliance with Title IV and found and concluded by providing six primary results from their study. First is that the schools did not appear to routinely monitor all servicer activities related to this contracted function, referring to their contracts with these third-party disbursement firms. The schools did not prevent their servicers from using marketing and other strategies to persuade students to select their debit card or other available options. As you all saw, these debit cards on some campuses were framed as student IDs, had the campus's logo, and were sent in. It would be sent in a letter that implies that the card is being sent on behalf of the institution rather than a third-party company. And that in some cases, fees appear to be unique unique or higher than those of alternative financial services. Additionally, schools had financial incentives in their contracts with servicers that created potential conflicts of interest. As you heard from Representative Holvey, there are some institutions that have entered into revenue sharing agreements with these third-party institutions. I believe Higher One is contracted with over now 600 institutions nationwide, and at least 70 of those institutions have revenue sharing agreements in their contracts. Schools that contracted with Higher One had fee-free ATMs on campus, but schools that had contracted with Sallie Mae did not. Schools provided or services collected student information that was not needed to deliver credit balances, so student information beyond what was necessary to provide financial aid refunds through these companies was provided to these third-party companies. So as you've also heard, there are three bills that we're speaking of today, House Bill 2254, House Bill 2832, and House Bill 3184, as well as multiple amendments to all of those bills. So I wanted to provide a summary of what we're looking at and also recognize that we are putting these ideas forward as a way to start a conversation and engage in the complex nature of this issue to hopefully find a single vehicle to approach this issue with. But the overall summary that we want to get across is that we need to focus on the lack of transparency and clarity with alternative methods of disbursement, fee schedules, and institutional contracts. That access to financial aid should not have financial barriers, and that stronger trust and financial aid disbursement systems need to be a priority for decision makers locally, also recognizing that there's little to no action being taken on the federal level. I'll conclude before I turn over to Mario by saying that we need to focus on protecting our institution's most financially needy students and protecting them as consumers of our institutions.
Thank you, Mr. Newell.
Thank you.
Mr. Parker Milligan.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Again, my name is Mario Parker Milligan, Legislative Director with the Oregon Student Association. We've been prioritizing this issue now for a couple of years, and this is the furthest along the road to protecting student financial aid and increasing transparency on all of our campuses. I will say, although we're talking about a few of our many campuses in Oregon, because there is a, I would say, like Representative Johnson mentioned earlier, that institutions have moved in this direction because of a lack of state investment, and it is more affordable for institutions to take this on than doing this in-house. I would argue we have an opportunity to increase the access of higher education by protecting financial aid access points, such as disbursement. While some institutions are taking steps to make their contracts more transparent and to create fairer contracts for students, we do need statewide action. Like Eric mentioned and like the representatives mentioned earlier, there is little to no action happening nationally. And for the sake of time, I'll cut my my remarks short because I know we have a number of our students here to share their stories with you and institutions wanting to speak as well. But we'll allow for any questions if you have any.
That's nice of you. Any questions for these gentlemen? Representative Hayden.
A couple of quick questions, and thank you, Chair Reed, and they may be addressed down the road here, but just I just want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. The presentation, nice presentation, thank you. Presentation indicated there that the fees between 2012 and 2013 have dropped by 12%. Is that going in the right direction?
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, I would argue that it's a start. In looking at that revenue, we were able to look at Higher One Holdings Incorporated, specifically their annual financial report, and their report cited that they have since I think 2011 started moving away from certain fees that would continue to charge students over and over again for an inactive account or for excessive overdrafts. And so in getting rid of a couple of those fees on their schedule, that's where they credited their loss, their slight loss in revenue on that regard. The reason the overall percentage of the total revenue dropped from 76% to 64% was that the revenue in which they received from institutions and from additional sources has increased. So overall, the revenue has increased from $176 million to $211 million and has really leveled off. We saw that double from 2009 to 2010. But to conclude, I would say that that's not quite as far as we need to go, specifically looking at the non-Higher One ATM fee and the debit swipe fee, specifically, which we wish to prohibit for students.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So a little more work there to go. And then the second question that I had on your slide, and they weren't numbered, so I can't give you a page. You indicated that 22% of the students felt that they understood the fee. Mm-hmm. You also indicated that 22% of the students felt that the fees were appropriate. Are those the same two 22%? Ooh. So is there an opportunity for education here also?
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, thank you for your question. I can't speak to if those were the exact same 22% of students who responded to that, but I would overall argue for a necessity of increased Financial responsibility education, or financial literacy education, I should say. I know that I was able to graduate high school without any sort of class on financial literacy. I know that in my college career I haven't been, and many of my peers have not been offered any sort of financial literacy resources beyond potentially optional trainings from financial aid departments that aren't well attended by students and aren't typically well advertised. So I think that that question would dovetail well into a conversation about how to improve financial literacy resources for students at our institutions, as well as prepare students better in terms of financial literacy before they enter college.
Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Nierman and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Reed. So, Mr. Knoll or Mr. Parker Milligan, for either one of you guys, I'm interested in the process of when – somehow you had to get involved with Hire One. You had to get an account for that, and I can't imagine that they just that the credit card just showed up in your thing. So somewhere along the line, I applied to be a student at PSU, and then I applied for a bunch of financial aid, and then I went through something somewhere where I filled out a form to say this is my PIN number and this is my address or whatever with Hire One. So tell me about that process. So that had to happen somewhere.
Thank you, Chair Reed, Representative Nierman. The card shows up at a point after you accept your financial aid packages. So at the time of enrollment, you enroll, you apply for financial aid, you accept your financial aid, and in my case, when I was a student, the card showed up before term started in my mailbox, and unbeknownst to me when it happened that this was going to be the option moving forward. And to access any of the options that Eric presented earlier for opting out, you had to log on to the website and create your account. So there was no point before receiving the card that I was given the option, and students are given the option to say, like, I don't want this card option. Do you have anything else to add, Eric?
Chair Reed, Representative Nierman, the only piece I would have to add is to note that at least from PSU, I can't speak to the other five institutions. All of the financial refund that is sent to students is still channeled through Hire One, so you have to use their service even in receiving a direct deposit or paper check.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric, I've got a few questions for you. On your slide that discussed the different, I guess, three different choices on the disbursement of funds and stuff, you did mention that there could be or would be a charge for a paper check, but wouldn't it be better for a student to maybe, whatever the charge or fee would be, have one fee for disbursement of that lump sum, and then that student could be responsible for how he or she managed those resources over the course of that semester, or put them into another type of account that wouldn't be quite as onerous or have the other fees associated with it? And based on your answer, I think I might have a follow-up.
Okay. Chair Reed, Representative Johnson, thank you for your question. I'll start by saying that students in general aren't opposed to having their financial aid on an easy access debit card. The fact that the financial aid comes back on a debit card instantly and is easily accessible to students is not the issue. It's the fee schedule associated with it. It's the lack of transparency and how to avoid those fees that becomes the issue for students. And I don't know how well I can answer your question specifically on the topic of a single fee charge for a lump sum being provided back to students, but I will say that the entire refund when selecting a direct deposit or a paper check still comes back to students in full.
Well, we live in that kind of a world today where anything that entails, let's say, human involvement has a higher cost associated to it. If I was going to pick up the phone and try to buy a couple of tickets to Maui this morning, but I wanted to go through the Alaska agent directly rather than book online, it would cost me a little bit more for that privilege. So I'm just saying it's not uncommon in this world to encounter that. But the other thing that I remember that came out in our testimony 2 years ago is that many of these students who are choosing the cards for their way to manage their resources
don't have the ability to obtain credit any other way. They don't come to their institution with a credit history that would enable them perhaps to open up an account in another bank. So I wonder how much that actually factors into the choices that students are making, because they just couldn't take that lump sum, go to First Interstate, go to U.S. Bank or whatever, and open up, because they don't have a credit history to work with, perhaps. Does that also perhaps factor into the issue that we're talking about?
Yeah. Chair Reed, Representative Johnson, I don't know the total amount of unbankable students per campus. I do know it's, I think, less than 10%, I would assume, on most of our campuses. So a part of the issue is like having access to a bank account or a credit union. I would argue a lot. I've had many friends and students we've worked with who do have no credit or terrible credit, and they are able to access a low cost alternative from a local community credit union that does provide a simpler fee schedule and oftentimes lower costs for maintaining their account over the period of a year or the term that they're in school.
Certainly, one of the things we hear consistently from banks and credit unions about how much effort they're making to make products and services available to people who otherwise can't get them. Other
one
questions?
One more quick follow-up. Eric, you also mentioned revenue sharing, I think, in Representative Holby's bill. It's in here, too. Do you have information or something you can point to directly with Oregon institutions that have engaged in or have been involved in revenue sharing amongst the institutions in recent history?
Chair Reed, Representative Johnson, thank you for your question. I don't have a lot of information related to revenue sharing. One of the reasons for that is we don't, as students, generally have access to the contracts, so we don't know necessarily if an institution is engaged in revenue sharing. I do know in that being involved with Portland State's contract renegotiations last year, we had built a very good relationship with the Director of Contracts and Procurement, and he was able to provide us that contract and explain that Portland State had written out of their contract revenue sharing, which we very much appreciated. But that's also part of the reason we are in support of House Bill 2832 from Representative Nathanson, is to provide us that transparency and public access to the contract so that we can understand better what those contracts look like. I would encourage you to ask the question to institutions or directors of financial aid who may have more expertise with the language of the contracts.
So Representative Reardon has a question too. I just want to know for the committee and in the interest of the clock, we have a number of other people who are going to testify on the bills as well. So
just real quick, yep. Just an observation that it seems like the way this is set up, that the university is obviously endorsing one system, makes it very easy, makes it, and so the student be apt to believe that someone at the university level is really watching out for their interest, and I think that's the perception that the student would obviously have. But the question is, has anybody put together some kind of a table that compares the cost of different options? So if do this company versus Wells Fargo versus credit union, is that on a table anywhere?
It's not one that I have. I'm happy to have someone answer that. My guess is that a table like that would be would have a perishable characteristic to it in that the options might change over time. But I think
even
I get
a snapshot
your point.
Might be helpful.
Yeah, I understand. So perhaps we can look into that.
Okay.
Other questions for either of these gentlemen? Thank you very much. In the interest of time, I'm going to try to proceed through our list without particular regard for where people might be on the bill or their affiliation. So with that, Amanda Nguyen from Portland State, Ashley Jackson, and Seth Joyce, please. Ms. Nguyen, you want to get us started, please?
So, Chair Reid and Committee, for the record, my name is Amanda Nguyen, and I'm the Director of Student Financial Services at Portland State University. I have been at Portland State since 2009 and served as the Director over Student Financial Services since 2010, which includes overseeing the function of disbursement of financial aid and refunds to our students. I'd like to start with, we strongly support the spirit of House Bill 3184, 2254, and 2832. And protecting students financially is a shared concern and priority for all of us. Approximately 60% of our students receive financial aid, and we use the Hire One disbursement tool for all of our financial refunds, which includes financial aid, but also any other credit balance refunds to our students. And we do as much as we can to encourage our students to choose the ACH direct deposit over opening a one account if that's a viable option for them. I'd also like to clarify that PSU, Portland State, in contract with Hire One, has no PIN fees for transactions, no inactivity fee for not choosing the debit account, and then we also, with Hire One, withhold a discretionary amount to be able to waive other fees that students incur, like an NSF fee or anything else on their account through our petition process with the school. So we do seek to involve the students and to partner and work on their behalf to help them. So while we agree with Spirit, the provisions outlined would pose some challenges to ensuring the best possible outcome for our students. We have very favorable terms in our current contract with Hire One, and retaining this ability to negotiate directly on behalf of our students is of our utmost importance. Specifically, it would complicate the negotiations of these types of contracts, I believe, and further diminish the student involvement and input in the process. In our most recent contract negotiations, our student government provided valuable student feedback and engaged in open dialogue with our vendor. And we're also sensitive to the changing financial climate in determining the length of our contract agreement. We purposely made it short so that we could watch what the Department of Education was doing in the CFPB as well as this legislative body. So it is our concern that that flexibility and student involvement in these negotiations may be lost or diminished. So I'd be happy to provide the committee with any constructive suggestions for the bill. The provisions outlined in House Bill 2254, such as providing clear fee schedules, the student's choice in the method of disbursement, and the timeliness of access to funds, as well as the removal of revenue sharing, have all been incorporated into our current contract. And while this protects the students' interests, we feel these can be negotiated at the university level or in cooperation with our other institutions on behalf of the students to ensure the best rates and services for them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Let's hear from the students, and then we'll see if there are questions. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chair Reed and Representative Gallegos and members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Ashley Jackson. I am a student at Lane Community College. I am also here with the Oregon Student Association to urge your support for House Bill 2254, House Bill 2832, and House Bill 3184. As a single mother and a first-generation student, financial literacy is second to survival. Education creates a pathway out of a system that can often be stacked against the uneducated, and particularly in the case of financial literacy. The fact that our student dollars are being swept away by corporate disbursement managers via predatory fees is an utter disgrace. Passing HB 2254, 2832, and 3184 would send an urgent message to students across the state that elected officials care about protecting students who are increasingly the target of predatory corporations such as Hire One. I ask that all of you protect the investment in the Oregon Opportunity Grant that are made from taxpayers' hard-earned money. As a student who uses such a system, the predatory fees are ridiculous. Every time I use my Hire One debit card that I have in my pocket, I will show you, it says debit card on it. Get that 50-cent charge every single time. Moreover, there's two ATMs for all the students at Lane Community Colleges. Those lines take almost an hour to get through when disbursements hit. And that's sometimes really, like, we don't have an hour to sit and wait to get money out of the ATM for free. Sometimes it is more cost-effective, time-wise, to go pay that $2.50 fee to use a different ATM that doesn't have a line out of the building. These fees may not seem significant as, say, 50 cents or $2.50, but they when they accumulate, that's a huge amount of money. I also want to point out that we can only withdraw $500 a day from these ATMs. So this limit and dynamic makes paying rent without spending that, without getting an extra fee tacked on to it, really hard. You have to either go 3 days in a row and pull $500 out every single day to pay your bills, or you have to use the credit feature or pay the extra $18 or the other fees to transfer the money. I wish I could say that this, my personal experience, was one of the extreme cases, but it really isn't. It's just a pretty typical reoccurrent theme you see at Lane Community College and the other colleges that have higher one contracts. I worked as a treasurer in the student government, and one day I had a student in full-blown hysterics come up to the office because the financial aid department and the college itself just turned her away when she had a malfunction, or when the ATM machine malfunctioned, and took $500 out of her account, but never actually spit the money out. She was in full-blown tears, so I went downstairs, got the 1-800 number off of the ATM, and then called it myself. I was hung up on twice. Then I called the third time, finally got connected to an agent, and by that point, she had calmed down, and I handed the phone to her. She went through that process. It seemed like one of those roundabout, well, have you talked to this person? Have you talked to that? End of the story, her family was trying to move into a new home, and her family suffered a severe risk to their stability because of that $500 disappearing from her account. It took over 6 weeks to recover that money. I would never, ever put my money in a corporation or a bank that had customer service that low par. However, it's really not plausible when you're living off financial aid to wait that extra time to get the money in a different way. Moreover, it's not presented to students the options that are out there. You are encouraged to use Higher One. You are lobbied by your enrollment service staff to use Higher One. They streamline that process, but if you try to do the direct, or if you try to do a direct deposit or a paper check, there are so many flaming hoops that most students don't even consider it because we can't wait, we don't understand the language, or it just seems like more hoops to jump through that we've already, and we're already exhausted at that point.
Ms. Jackson, I hope you're reaching the conclusion.
I am reaching
Thank
the
you.
End of it.
Thank
I am
you.
Reaching the end of it. I just want to point out that, once again, this is a weight on the shoulders of the new future workforce. We are already taking loans out. We are getting money from taxpayers for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and this money is being funneled to Connecticut. We want that money to stay here. That's why we're going to school in Oregon. That's why most of us will get jobs in Oregon. And I urge each member of this committee with the utmost urgency to look into these bills. I also want to point out House Bill 2254, the line 16, 17, and 18, reads that the options be clearly explained to the student, all of the ways to access their money. That should already be happening. I think I think everyone in this room has really spoke to that. So I just want to urge each member here to do what you can to pass these bills out of committee and protect the investment in higher education and our tax dollars.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Seth.
Chair Reed and Vice Chair Gallegos. My name is Seth Joyce, and I'm a student at Lane and a representative for Oregon Student Association. I thank you for the opportunity to tell you my story about these bills. I started classes at Lane 4 years ago while I was in high school. At the time, my parents were married and could be considered the upper middle class of Eugene. 1 year prior to my graduation, they got a divorce, my mom lost her job, and our financial situation kind of tumbled. At the time when we filed financial aid, my parents had been married and my mom had made enough money to make financial aid minimal and not something that I really considered. However, since the divorce, my mom has been unable to help me financially, and I was pretty much told if I wanted to attend higher education, I would be paying the majority of it. I graduated high school, and wanting to continue my education, I got a job for the summer and worked as long as I could to make the money I would need to become a full-time student until I could again pick up a job and continue where I left off. Currently, I'm in that situation where I need financial aid. I've applied for it, and I hope to get it soon. Honestly, I was really unaware of the situation, and after applying for it and coming to Lane and hearing the students' stories of what is going on, I'm a little terrified. I really do want to continue my education. I've already given up my plans of going to OSU immediately following graduation, and I'm going to Lane, and I want to continue going to Lane.
Take your time, that's fine.
It's been brought to my attention that there are a whole bunch of problems. I've learned from various peers of mine that there are things that they're not sure why are happening, and it's a lot of the problems with ATM, as previously mentioned, the fact that there are the two designated ATMs, the fact that there are debit fees and an unclear alternative options, unclear fee schedules, and I'm getting into this unaware, and it's really terrifying, as I've said. But I know that being part of government, relatively new to government, I know that I can try to urge you to support these bills. House Bill 2254, House Bill 3184, and House Bill 2832. Thank you for hearing my story, and I urge you to remember me when voting on this bill.
Thanks for coming to testify. We appreciate it. The questions for this panel?
Thank you, Chair Reed. And I'll ask this question of the lending institutions also, but I want to get some perspective since I don't have the history of being in the legislature. My understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is that the state, Oregon, decided to go with this process to save money. And it sounds like from the students' position that cost shifted too much through fees to the students. So is the concern from the students' opinion that the lending institutions are making too much money, or is it that the state cost shifted too much of that burden to the students? So who is this legislation seems to be aimed at the lending institution, but in order for them to save the state the amount of money that the state wants to save, they're going to have some base fee. And even if we said you can't have any student fees, then those fees would have to then come back from the state. So is it the opinion of the students that the lending institutions are just making too much money, or that the state shifted too much cost on the students?
Chair Reed and Representative Hayden, thank you very much for your question. I would say, as a representative of Lane Community College, that that too much of that weight was shifted onto students' backs where there was already too much. I think that the point here is that students are coming to learn, and they don't have the skills upon entering college to be able to make a wise decision and a prudent decision with their money. And whereas there's other alternatives that are very viable, they're not presented to us. Instead, we are preyed upon. The money that these third-party financial firms are making, that bothers me, it upsets me, especially when I'm going into debt to try to deliver myself from poverty. However, I look more at the fact that we're already forking over in 2010, we were forking over 50% of the entire revenue for our college. We shouldn't have more weight on our shoulders because there aren't viable options being explored by our institutions and by our government. That's my opinion, and that's as far as my peers I would be able to speak to. So thank you very much for your question.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. We have four more people on our list, and then a different bill. So let's Paula Gonzalez and John Wyckoff, please. Is Ms. Gonzalez, do you want to start us with, we'll continue the theme? I think if I'm reading this right, you are also a student, so we can hear from you first, and then
yeah,
Mr. Wyckoff.
Great. Of course. First of all, good morning, Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gallegos, and members of the committee. My name is Paola Gonzalez, and I'm a student at Lynn Benton Community College and a resident of Lynn County. And today, I would like to speak to you on behalf of the Oregon Student Association in support of House Bill 2254 and House Bill 2832. So, I began college right after high school. I jumped into a new environment with a whole new set of challenges, and one of the most frustrating challenges was higher one. Portland State University had my financial aid, the very thing I needed to survive, distributed to one of the most restrictive student distribution agencies. Not only did I have to deal with the struggles of being a first-generation college student and figuring out just how financial aid worked, now Higher One gave me a whole new set of rules to the thing that I had needed access to provide with the necessities such as shelter, transportation, and food. It was detrimental to my success at PSU to not have complete control over my financial aid. Because of these regulations, I encountered some of the most difficult times in my life. For example, I would see a $5 charge on my account, and I would have no idea why I was being charged, so I would have to go out of my way and call Higher One to have them explain to me why there was a $5 charge on my statement. But by far the worst experience at that time when I was going at Portland State University was finding out that I had a $300 withdrawal cap per day on my financial aid, a cap that I was not informed of or agreed to. And because of this cap, I couldn't take out the $450 I needed per month to pay for my rent. So I was late on paying my rent. And this is one of the many factors why I moved back to Albany to continue my education in Lynn Benton Community College, a college where I didn't have to deal with a restricted student fund agency. So it is for students like myself that I ask for your support on House Bill 2254 and House Bill 2832, so that students aren't financially preyed upon by these agencies that don't properly disclose fees and restrict a student's ability to have full control over their means of survival. So I really ask you, please support House Bill 2254 and House Bill 2832. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's go, let's depart from the norm a little bit and ask if there are any questions for Ms. Gonzalez, and then we can, then you don't have to sit up there while Mr. Wyckoff goes on and on, right?
Oh, and I'm going.
I'm kidding. Any questions for Ms. Gonzalez? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank
we appreciate
you for your time.
Mr. Wyckoff, I was just kidding, please.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I will try to keep my comments relatively brief. I want to just talk a little bit about why the colleges will use third-party vendors, maybe clarify a couple of points. But overall, to say, we think most of the pieces in these in this sort of set of three bills are workable and provide good common sense protections that we would like to be a constructive part of helping to implement. There are a couple of pieces that we have some concern with, but I wanted to give just a little bit of background. And you've heard some folks say that, you know, for the colleges and universities, financial aid is one of those areas where you ramp up for a kind of discrete part of each term, and then you don't need the same number of employees. So it's a costly thing to sort of ramp up and down. And I wanted to get to one point that's been made several times about sort of cost shifting. And I think it's important to remember that when students are the tuition payer, you're shifting cost from students to students, right? There was no outside entity paying for our financial aid offices to distribute financial aid for which students did not foot the bill. What has changed is the colleges or universities have moved to what they see as a lower cost alternative to do it. Now, what the students are concerned about is that the fee structure for the Higher One account has some fees that traditional bank accounts, or has a fee that traditional bank accounts wouldn't have, and that is that 50 cent. And that's only at some campuses. Not all contracts have that. And that's a 50-cent PIN transaction fee. Now, the way you get around that fee is by, you know, if you go to the grocery store and it says enter your PIN and you kind of hit and you hit cancel and then you do a signed transaction instead. You can do it standardly at any store. But the problem is folks don't know to do it. And then they get this 50-cent fee that surprises them. They can get that overturned by calling Hire One. But I remember trying to navigate the banking system when I was a student. And it's difficult to understand. It's something you haven't done before. It's things like that. There is a standard. I have a standard $500 a day on my Chase account that I, you know, from ATMs that I can't withdraw more than that. Right? I mean, these are sort of, many of these are standard banking procedures. You know, for example, if a student wants their financial aid put into their own account and not the Hire One account, it's free to do. It's wire transfers later down the road for which there would be a fee, which is a normal banking procedure. But it's free to have that money transferred. It takes 2 to 3 days because of, I think, federal banking regulations that it goes through the Federal Reserve from one bank and then back to the other bank. So some of these are standard. What is not standard is that, and is not a standard in the industry, is that 50-cent fee for PIN transactions. We don't think that that is probably going to be in any future contracts, that is probably being phased out regardless, but have no problem with that being prohibited as the legislation has done. The other issue that that I did want to touch on briefly was the issue of profit sharing. My understanding is there was one campus at one time in Oregon that did that, but it is not something that Hire One likes to do. It is not something that's in contracts. I think in that way it's a bit of a red herring, but we have no problem with a ban on it because nobody's really doing it, and so that's fine. I can completely understand why people would be uncomfortable with that if the college or university has a stake in moving people to this account instead of their own account. And so we have no problem moving in that direction. The one piece where we I think universities and colleges have a little bit of concern, and the AG's office has, or Attorney General's office has a concern, is the actual capacity there to do review of contracts. That's a step we would be uncomfortable with. We have just generally, I mean, regardless of what area it's in, we have locally elected boards who are elected by voters to exercise this kind of responsibility, and we would just have concerns about whether the Attorney General's office really has the capacity to do that. But the rest of the pieces in here that I think are consumer protection pieces or transparency pieces, we're fully comfortable with. As a public contract is a public document, and if somebody were to make a request for it, it should be handed over to them. And if that hasn't been done in a way that's easy to do, I mean, we're comfortable with making that more available than I think that there might be an understanding that it currently is. So again, overall, we're comfortable with most of the directions that these are moving in. There are a couple of pieces. One is the review piece that we would be a little, well, that's really the main piece that we would be concerned with. And I think the rest is workable, and we want to be constructive in helping make that work.
Very good. Before I ask for questions, let me invite Dana and Drew Johnston up so they'll have a chance to get settled while we have questions for you. Representative McEwen.
Oh, this will be very short, Chair Reed. Thank you. On the community college system, do you have a global contract, or each one of your 17 campuses individually negotiating? And are they all Hire One, or is there another vendor in there?
Chair Reed, Representative McEwen, the contracts are with individual campuses across. I mean, that's just standard. We have a few. I think we have three campuses who are using Hire One. Some do in-house. There are other banks that will sometimes respond to RFPs for this. But I believe right now we have three who are using Hire One. And I think it's important to say too, students have been involved in the process when they go out for bid, and have been involved with choosing whichever vendor gets chosen. And just if I may, really quickly, it is my understanding that also Hire One is a bank, but these are not credit cards. It's not a lending institution. These are debit cards, it's dispersing your financial aid, and it could be dispersing loan money from the federal government, but they are not the lender.
Just to clarify, so three institutions in the community college system are using an outside vendor, and the other 14 are all doing it in-house?
I'd want to go back and make sure I have that exact number right, because it may not be that many that are all totally in-house.
Okay. Three hire one.
Yeah.
And the rest are some combination
something
of something
okay,
else.
Okay, great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Ms. Richardson? Ms. Johnston?
Good morning. For the record, my name is Dana Richardson. I'm the Deputy Director for Legislative and Policy Affairs at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We've submitted written testimony. The amendments generally have removed us from providing contract review or guidance in publishing contracts. We think that makes sense. We'd like to help and are just available to kind of figure out how we can best add value. If a shared services sort of approach is pursued, we think that might have some merit and just kind of stand ready to help as we could.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Johnston.
Chair Reed and members of the committee, my name is Drew Johnston, Legislative Director for the Oregon State Treasury. I just want to make two quick points. For House Bill 2832, I would appreciate Representative Nathanson working with us on dash ones that make it crystal clear that the focus is between financial institutions and not state agencies, as the bill could possibly be read. And then on House Bill 3148, just wanted to quickly state that Treasury is opposed to the kind of lead role envisioned in the introduced bill, both because that's kind of outside of our normal state of affairs, but also because Treasury doesn't bank the community colleges, and we're not required to bank the universities going forward, so a little less leverage in the kind of lead position that we would think might be necessary that the bill kind of envisions. But we certainly understand there's different ways the drafters are looking forward to do it, and we could be maybe helpful in a consultant role going forward. But
thank you. Questions for any of these folks? Good. Don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. That completes the list of people who have signed up to testify on 2254, 3184, and 2832. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? I don't see anyone. So, okay, thanks. So we're gonna before I close the public hearings on those bills, seems to me there's some work to be done. We heard from two of the proponents. I will just encourage them to continue that work. When I stepped out, I didn't get to ask the question of sort of if there's a preferred approach, but it sounds like that's still developing. So we'll monitor that and hope to be back to it before long. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2254, House Bill 2832, and House Bill 3184. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2525. We are expecting Representative Witt. In the meantime, Brian, do you want to give us a summary of the bill, please?
Chair Reed, members of the committee. House Bill 2525 directs Higher Education Coordinating Commission to develop standards relating to transferability of credits and acceptance of test scores for community colleges and public universities.
Thank you. So hopefully Representative Witt will be appearing momentarily. We're going to stand at ease for a moment until he does. So we'll be stand at ease. So come back to order. We've been waiting patiently for Representative Witt. Unfortunately, we've been unable to find him. So we're going to carry the bill over and give him a chance to testify later on. Before we do that, however, we do have three people who have testified, who have signed up to testify, one of whom has come a distance. So before we disperse for the day, let's hear from him. The three, and since we have three chairs, Jeff Dentz, Dana Richardson, Lita Colligan, please.
Good. Let me go first. Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Lita Colligan, Associate Vice President for Strategic Partnerships and Government Relations at Oregon Tech. Like Dana, I can almost say my title in one breath. I was going to get up and say ditto to Dana's testimony because it got posted twice on your website, and I did ask our committee assistant to post mine too, so you have that now if you haven't read it.
Thanks.
But basically, I'll make my comments very short. I'm speaking on behalf of all seven public universities. We wholeheartedly support the intent of House Bill 2525. We are working very hard together, all of us, with the community colleges to make sure that students can transfer credits between institutions as easily as possible. That work is already well underway in collaboration with the HEC, and we hope it will continue. And we are aware that Representative Reed may form a group of some kind to help us align the interests in this bill along with House Bill 2681 and 82, both of which you had testimony on earlier this week. And we're really happy to contribute to that process. So I'll keep my comments short.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gallegos, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dana Richardson, Legislative Director, no, policy, Deputy Director for Legislative and Policy Affairs at the Higher Education Coordinating
Commission. That was three breaths this time, wasn't it?
How many? So House Bill 2525 deals primarily with the transferability of credits and acceptance of test scores by universities and colleges. I don't want to belabor the different efforts that are going over on with regard to these issues, but I don't want to gloss over them either. So they are in your written testimony, but they include the development of the Oregon Transfer Module, transfer degree tracks that have been developed for the Associate of Arts, Associate of Science with an emphasis in business, and the Associate of Science with an emphasis in computer science. There's been work going on in dual credit standards, placement policies that we talked about on Monday with regard to House Bill 2681. We've submitted reports, as has been directed by the legislature, on the Transfer Student Bill of Rights, and put together a work group on student transfers. So, as I say, I don't want to belabor it, but I do want you to be aware of what we're currently working on and really have been charged to work with. One thing I would like to bring to your attention, kind of highlight, is an effort that we conduct a statewide transcript audit study. I think what happens a lot of times is you talk with an individual who's had an issue where they've lost credits and that sort of thing, but what we really need to do is understand what's happening system-wide. So many of the things that we're working on are considered best practices, so I think really getting a sense of the scope is going to be so helpful in these conversations. So we are planning to do work on that. If the chair pulls together a work group on these and Representative Comps bills, of course we'd love to participate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dance, thanks for reminding us of your travels here. I fear we might have overlooked that had you not raised it. Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity. Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gallegos, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Dance. I'm president of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate. We represent the faculty at Oregon's public universities. IFS greatly appreciates the focus the sponsors of House Bill 2525 have placed on the important issue of transferability of credits between community colleges and universities. In order for the state to achieve its ambitious 40-40-20 goals, students and parents need to be provided a clear and transparent picture by which they can navigate the pathway of higher education. House Bill 2525 is a step in the right direction. However, certain aspects of the current language of the bill may prove problematic in its implementation. Specifying the parameters of what constitutes a, quote, sufficiently similar, end quote, course offering can be achieved by development of a common course numbering system for lower division courses where students are provided clear information on what is recognized as a course equivalency. This goal can be achieved by the Higher Education Coordinating Commission utilizing its convening authority to bring together faculty, grouped by academic discipline, to align course numbering between Oregon's community colleges and universities. Common course numbering holds significant promise in addressing the sufficiently similar provisions of House Bill 2525. A more challenging aspect of the bill is Section 13C. While nationally developed tests such as Advanced Placement and the International Baccalaureate Diploma are generally accepted by higher education institutions in Oregon, the bill's provisions that, quote, test developed by a community college or university, end quote, is an indication of a student's coursework proficiency is problematic. Issues of validity and reliability have been exhaustively addressed as part of the development process for AP and IB programs. This provision may result in a plethora of test instruments which have the potential to undermine academic quality, the bedrock principle of higher education in Oregon. IFS respectfully submits the phrase, quote, or a test developed by a community college or university, end quote, be deleted from the current draft of House Bill 2525. Thank you for your time, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions, Representative Hayden?
Quick question.
That's fine.
Chair Reed, with your suggested implementation of kind of consolidating the course number, makes sense. But from the aspect of retroactively, students that have previously taken courses, like myself, I have maybe a conflict of interest here.
No, Representative Hayden, I'm sure you're part of a very large class, so I don't think
it's so. In my personal experience, I was able to go through high school in 3 years and then college and get accepted to a professional school on kind of a fast-track system, and wasn't able to complete my college requirement, my last 36 hours at the physical facility that I should have gotten my degree from, so I had to take a choice of skipping a year of school and going and taking a couple classes there or going on. So looking at it, not for me, but for many, many people retroactively, how would you address that issue?
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, thank you for your question. That's one of the problematic aspects of implementation of this particular policy. I believe at this juncture, to look back at this retroactively, the individual institutions have the ability to grant course equivalency on a case-by-case basis. I'm not sure legislating retroactively might make sense. What is the time parameter that we might do that from? But certainly all students have the ability to petition their individual institutions for course equivalency. That's usually granted by the faculty in the particular discipline in which you're making the request.
Can follow up.
Yes, please.
And they certainly have the ability to say no.
As I've done several times.
Terry?
Yes, please.
I would just like to respond to that. As in my testimony, written testimony, I did raise the issue, and all of you are very aware of this, that a lot of times this is because students change majors. Mm-hmm. And you all know that because you've heard testimony on this many times.
And probably because some of us have done it, too.
Well, sure. And so, you know, we are really working hard to transfer every credit we can, and we do lots of waivers do make the transitions for students as easily as we can. But if they change majors, the credits are there. It's just that they don't apply in their major, and they still have to take the rest of those courses.
Understood. Representative Reardon?
If I understand this project correctly, there you need to get people at 24 or so different institutions to agree on the content of the courses and which courses, and
you're trying to make us feel better, Representative Reardon?
No. Does this process that's being outlined in this bill, would that give you enough specificity about which courses you're talking about? And then also, reading it, I couldn't tell, when does this work need to be done? And if it doesn't get done, what happens?
Representative Reardon, I'm going to break in and answer that question to a degree, and then certainly you can add to it or correct me. I think one of the interesting things about this is between this bill and the bills that Representative Comp brought us on similar topics, both in terms of the testing and in terms of the transferability, there may be an opportunity to merge these. So I guess I would just say, gently urge you not to get too keyed in on the details yet. But I think you're making a good point with your question, and they're certainly free to answer.
Okay. I just recognize what a big task this could be. That's
absolutely. Representative Gallegos? Oh, well, did you have a comment first?
Chair Reed, I was just going to respond that it is a big task, and this is why the bills really, both of them, direct us to continue to work with the HEC as a convener of the colleges and universities. We just last week had all the provosts and all the chief instructional administrators meeting to work on accelerated credit, all these transition issues that the colleges and universities are working on together. So it's not going to be solved with one bill. It certainly will help give us direction that you think it's important and that we need to continue the work.
Right. Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I just want to say the implication is so vast, I mean, of what this could mean. I mean, not just in terms of financial aid to students and their expenses, but, you know, when you talk about switching majors, I was so frustrated when community college students would come to our program and half of their credits simply didn't apply. Mm-hmm. Or they would come in with tremendous number of credits that just got put into an elective file.
Right.
And it's not fair. I mean, the cost to them and all. Yeah. But the other thing that I wonder how we're going to address with this work group maybe is the idea that oftentimes when students change majors, and if we're doing our STEM and our sciences, oftentimes I would find nursing students who would hit organic chemistry. That would sort of be the tipping point, you know. Once they had a hard time with organic chemistry, then they would switch over to the social sciences right away. But I think, you know, how do we sort of manage that is quite, it's quite a challenge.
Indeed it is.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciated your words about Common Course numbering. You know, it's something we have discussed at various times in my tenure here, and I think we've kind of looked at it holistically, and I think your comments were specifically addressed towards lower division courses, which might get to, I think, what this bill here perhaps is thinking about, but it might be much more attainable than simply looking across the, because a lot of these courses obviously are prereqs for various types of majors and so forth, but if we could accomplish that, that would be really successful. But Dane, I wanted to ask you specifically at the HEC, what's currently going on, if anything, regarding the course numbering process? Because again, we've touched on this each session that I've been here, and I think I forget where we have. Did we commission you to study something or come back with recommendations or not?
Chair Reed, Representative Johnson, I would say that it's an ongoing charge that we will be working on as long as we exist. I mean, that's really why we're here, right? I mean, it's one of the critical things that the legislature has asked us to do. So we, as Lita mentioned, convened folks just recently last week to continue working on. And the interesting thing to me is I've learned more about the Common Course numbering is that it's you don't just kind of finish it, because whenever a faculty person changes, if they want to change what they're teaching down the road, they need to go back through and make sure that the course that you thought was going to, you know, pull into that work still does. So it's really kind of an ongoing maintenance and in determining the learning outcomes that you need at this stage in order for it to build for the next stage, if that makes sense.
Just a quick follow-up. I would say, though, so other states have gotten there. And as I've attended conferences with other representatives and legislators from across the country, there have been times when, you know, the things that we can offer a carrot, an inducement for things to happen, there's other times when a legislative mandate expedites the process. So I don't want to get into that mode, but I do think there are might be times are necessary for us to say, we really would like to have this done by such and such a date, and just get everybody working towards that goal. And obviously, we help them as we can.
So, mindful of the clock here, no, Representative Hayden has a comment, which is fine. I do want to remind us that we have not completed our discussion on this bill. We're going to carry it over, and Representative Witt will have a chance to comment as well. So, Representative Hayden, very quickly, please.
Quick comment is just that I understand the switching majors, the course content. My concern is more if an educational institution is saying you have to take X amount of hours here, your last hours here, and it appears to be on a financial basis for the institution rather than a criteria of the courses, just saying you've got to take your last 10, 20, 30, 40 hours in order to graduate from here. I would hope that would be addressed.
We'll pick that up on Monday. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2525. Noting once again for the record, in an abundance of caution, carrying it over, so Representative Wood will have a chance to comment as well.
Wanted to ask.
We'll
thank
see.
Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. So, and we're adjourned. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
We're adjourned. Thank you.
Yeah.